things I've never told. Letting go has gotten me down. It's gonna be what it'll be. There ain't no sense in losing sleep. Daddy, I sure hope you're proud.
What's happening, everyone? Welcome back. It is Jay Scott, and it is The Hook Rocks, the ultimate rock community podcast. Thanks again for tuning in. We always appreciate it. Don't forget to write us a five-star review when you're done listening. We always appreciate the feedback, too, is when you enjoy the episode. We are part of the Pantheon Podcast Network, a great network of music-related podcasts, including the official Metallica podcast. You can catch on pantheonpodcast.com and all their social media links at Pantheon Pods on Threads, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can also check out The Hook Rocks on all those platforms at The Hook Rocks. And don't forget to set your app wherever you listen to podcasts to automatic download so you get the latest episodes right to your phone. We are 4.5 years into this journey of podcasting, and we've got about 555 episodes. We just released a great interview with Joe Satriani about his tour with Steve Vai, G3, and the upcoming Sammy Hagar tour. Said some interesting things about why the Alex Van Halen, David Lee Roth tour never came to fruition and why the Sammy Hagar tour came to be. So it's an interesting take from Joe on that. Don't forget Todd Damick-Hearns, who's about to kick off his tour with Slash, with Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, and the Gems, the great Swedish band, the formerly three members of Thunder Mother, who left and now started their own band, the Gems, are the latest new music spotlight guests. So please check out that as well. We've got a first-time guest today. Very happy to have this guest, been wanting to have her on for a while. She's got a fantastic new album out, and we're going to get into that. I'd like to welcome the incredible and the shred queen, Miss Sophie Lloyd. How are you doing?
Hello. Thank you so much. I love that intro. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're going to get to know you over the next 40 minutes or so. And, you know, we always ask the same first question every time we have a first-time guest. Okay. And that is really the essence of the show. Just like every rock song has a hook that pulls you in, every rock fan has a moment, whether it's a song, an album, a band, or performance that hooked them on rock and roll. What was it for you?
Mine is really embarrassing. So it's not like a cool rock star moment or anything. It was literally when I was a kid. It was an episode of SpongeBob SquarePants where he was doing like a version of Twisted Sister's I Wanna Rock. That was like, I'm a goofy goober of rock. And that is what got me into rock and roll. So not very cool, I'm afraid.
It is very unique. We've never heard the SpongeBob reference here on The Hook Rock. So you're first time for that. But hey, it's got to start somewhere, right?
Exactly. Exactly. It started when I was younger. And my dad was also really into rock and roll. So we'd always like have a lot of like old school like blues playing around the house. He loved like Joe Bonamassa, Rory Gallagher, people like that. So yeah, but that was the start.
Now, after the SpongeBob episode, where did it go from there? Like, what was your next thing for you to keep the drive into rock and roll going?
So I got my first guitar, which was just like one of those ones you get that's like comes with a set. It comes with like this little amp and a lead, everything you need, you know, to rock out. And I got it, and I really wasn't very good at it at all. And like I started having a few lessons at school, but it was all like kind of classical stuff, which was kind of boring. So I slipped away from it a little bit. But then I started getting really into rock music again. And especially Pantera. Like, I really wanted to play Cowboys from Hell. So then I started like picking up my guitar and actually sort of becoming quite dedicated to learning again.
Who were your first influences with guitar?
There's a few different ones. Like, I'd say Slash was a big one in terms of his playing and his like career path as well. Like, the fact he was the first person I saw that really kind of made a career from being like a guitarist in his own right and would release albums with different vocalists and stuff. Joe Satriani, who you mentioned you just had on the podcast, was always a really, really big influence for me as well. His album Surfing with the Alien was like the first kind of instrumental guitar album that I've got. And that was the first time I saw a guitarist release an album that was just guitar, and it told a story, and it told this whole, you know, amazing, you know, thing throughout the album, and it didn't have any vocals. And I thought that was really, really interesting as well. And, you know, I loved Zakk Wylde. I loved Dimebag Darrell for like their techniques and stuff. Paul Gilbert as well. Were all people I would listen to all the time.
You know, it's amazing about Joe. I just had him on the show, as I mentioned in the beginning. Like, here is a legendary guitar god telling me that he's learning, he has to practice the Eddie Van Halen stuff for the Sammy Hagar tour because it's so hard.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, when he says that, I'm like, but you're Joe Satriani.
You should play everything, right? Yeah. It's weird, like, because people like specialize, I guess, in their own techniques, and you become so comfortable with your playing style that suddenly when you're introduced to someone else's style, even if it might seem like kind of similar, it is a whole new world. It's a whole different way that you know, different pattern of fingering or something like that. Like, it is so, so different.
When you talk about the influences that you just mentioned and you talk about your playing, you know, I always say every time I have a guitar player on here is, you know, when you look at the instrument, just looking at it, it's very limited, you know, looking at it by the eye. But the guitar player unlocks its limitations. Like, it goes beyond those limitations. Every guitar player does that. When you approach the guitar and you mentioned those influences, what's your first approach to it? Like, is it phrasing? Is it feel? Is it touch? Is it being technical? How do you, like, when you pick up a guitar and you start to play and you're trying to figure out songs and melodies, where do you go first?
So I feel like I'm quite unique in the sense that I look at it quite strategically. I have quite like a logical brain. Like, I was really into like maths and science at school. I have this very logical brain. So I really look at shapes and patterns and like boxes and things like that. So I like kind of learning the rules of, you know, where exactly I can play, and then learning how to break those rules after I've got, you know, sort of more comfortable with them. And I think that's limited me in some senses, because I feel like maybe I can, like, sometimes I'm not very good at like improvisation and stuff like that. And sometimes I can lack a little bit of feel. So that's something I'm really trying to work on this year, is to kind of get more into just being like spontaneous and creative with it, and sort of break out of my like sort of logical, you know, logical boxes of what it should sound like and what should sound good. So that's something I'm working on. But I also think that approach has kind of made my playing kind of sound like me. It's kind of, I've made my own style because I have looked at it in kind of this more logical way and been creative in that kind of more mathematical way, which is interesting.
As far as your phrasing, the way you attack the guitar, the way you attack the note, you mentioned, you know, Joe Satriani, Zakk Wylde, Paul Gilbert, you know, these amazing guitar players. Do each of those guitar players influence more on certain areas of your playing, or is it just by and large a whole, you know, community of influence?
I'm not sure. I think it's definitely like, you know, techniques wise, I think I've got a lot of different techniques from kind of different guitarists. I can't really pinpoint exactly like kind of what came from where particularly, but I definitely tend to lean quite heavily on legato stuff, which I think sort of came from like Joe Satriani. Kind of, he does a lot of these beautiful legato licks, and the kind of more technical like scale shapes and kind of climbing the scale shapes like in a fast way, I think kind of came from Paul Gilbert stuff. Like, I think there's, and maybe like some more interesting kind of sweeps or arpeggios, kind of diminished arpeggios and stuff came from Paul Gilbert when I had to learn the gargoyle for my university final exam. So I think it's like, I'll definitely take things from different guitarists. And there's like something I do with my pick where I kind of scrape it along the strings and it goes like, sounds way cooler when you do it with strings. It doesn't sound like a dolphin like I just did then. But that was from Zach Wilde. He does it like with his pinky ring, which I think is really cool. So like I've kind of taken a lot of different techniques from different guitarists and kind of shoved them all together. But I'm trying to get into like gospel a bit more at the moment and to learn more like kind of interesting chord voicings and stuff and bring that into my music. That's what I'm trying to do at the moment.
I love the guitar. I love guitar players, and I just love seeing the differences. I love hearing the different tones. I love, you know, the guys and gals that are tone chasers and all that, and technical and feel. And, you know, I can go from listening to, you know, Joe Satriani live to, you know, Buddy Guy, you know, who's all feel, you know, Buddy Guy, just the way he attacks and how aggressive he is. And it's such a wide spectrum. You know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation wanting to be more spontaneous, have a little bit more feel in your playing. When you do go the technical aspect, or you play towards that at technical aspect, how hard is it to kind of keep an air of spontaneity there, or an air of feel there to the playing? Because I would imagine sometimes when you're technical, you're more concerned about the progression of the notes and how that all lays out and the presentation.
Yeah, definitely. Like sort of when it's technical, often you'll find like a lot of it is kind of pre-written, that you kind of know exactly where you should be, when, what box you should be in, and exactly where you're going, and you have this whole kind of plan in your head. And I think that definitely does make it quite hard to be spontaneous, because sometimes if you break out of that plan, suddenly you'll like panic and be like, I'm not where I am where I need to be for the next lick or something like that. So that can be quite a challenge. But I think the thing is with being technical, you kind of need to pick your moments. And that's something I've kind of realized as of late, where like you can do like this really cool technical run, but then you can follow it with like a really tasteful blues lick that you can be a little bit experimental with. And then, you know, you can go into another technical bit if you want. So it's basically like, I think the thing is with technicality is knowing your starting note and where you're going to finish that technical lick, but knowing where you are, like maybe like where you land in the minor pentatonic scale or something, for example. So then you can go into this, you know, tasteful lick afterwards and be a little bit expressional with that before then going into another technical aspect.
There's an amazing interview on YouTube that Paul Gilbert did with George Lynch. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to teach George Lynch music theory, and George Lynch doesn't want any part of it. And it's a funny back and forth between two legends about, and one has a different approach than the other, and you know, way is better than the other. It's just a different approach. You know, Paul's more technical, George is more feel. And I would think that coming from your world of being a very technical guitar player in music theory, that unlocking spontaneity can be dangerous, it can be fearful, but can also be very exciting too at the same time, because you don't really know where you're going to go at that point. So I know you mentioned like the panic of like being out of the, you know, out of what you thought the right chord progression was, but that's also kind of exciting in a way too.
Definitely. And that's kind of what I'm realizing at the moment, that I think I was kind of scared of doing it for so long. And the other guitarist in the band that I'm in, called Justin Lyons, he's incredible at spontaneity. Like he, sort of grew up like the gospel church. So he'd always be playing, you know, and just playing what he feels in his heart. And chatting to him, he's been helping me out with kind of how to approach that stuff and kind of how to just feel it and not worry if, you know, something may slip out that doesn't sound good, but that's okay. That's all part of it. Like it's just, you know, allowing yourself like that grace of being able to placing that doesn't sound good, but the next thing sounds amazing, you know, and not beating yourself up about that.
So the album, fantastic record, fantastic album. It's a collection of great songs. You have you have guest vocalists on all the tracks. And yeah, I think when you start off with Nathan Lane, you know, who is an amazing singer on the first track of the album, it really sets the tone for everything that came after that. When you were going into this album and approaching the different vocalists that you wanted to have, was the vision you had is to have these vocalists on there in the sequence that you put out the record in? Did that all go into it?
It was like the order of the songs and stuff kind of came afterwards once I'd heard what they'd created. And then I kind of followed the story through. But like before writing, I had like a list of names that I kind of wanted on the album for a bunch of different styles. So this was, as I kind of mentioned at the beginning, I was inspired by Slash's career and his first album, his self-titled album, where he had different musicians from all kinds of different genres. Like he had Fergie on it, and then he had Chris Cornell, and he had Lemmy and M Shadows and Dave Grohl. Like it was, I thought that was really, really cool how he kind of got all of these different musicians, but had this linear theme flowing through it. And you always knew it was Slash throughout the whole album. So I kind of wanted to do, you know, something like that, my own little like ode to that. So I had a list of all the people, and we wrote the songs without having the vocalists, you know, confirmed or anything. We wrote all of the instrumental bits first. So we basically kind of had these instrumental backing tracks that we went to the studio with and recorded well. And then we kind of sent them out to the vocalists. And surprisingly, most of them said yes, and they really liked the song. So, yeah, it was incredible. And it was really cool to have so many different styles. Like everyone on the album is someone that I've absolutely loved either growing up, or I've loved working with, or something like that. They all like hold a special place in my heart.
When you were selecting the vocalists, you know, you mentioned how much of a fan you were of these singers, but how, there's so many singers out there, how did you come to these vocalists that are on the album?
So I kind of had like my tops that I wanted. So I knew I wanted like Lizzie Hale. That was like my dream. And that was because she is my mum's favorite vocalist. So like, you know, I just have so many like memories of my mum, like would drive me to school and we'd be playing Hailstorm, like, you know, and singing it and stuff. So I kind of wanted that, like her on there for like, kind of like my mum in a way, if you know what I mean, just to like, cause I knew my mum would be listening to it working out. And I just felt like that would be really sweet. And a lot of them were just, you know, very similar. There were people like Steel Panther I had on my wall. I always thought their image was really funny. Like, I don't know. I just thought they were like a really cool band. Same with Trivium. There's this really funny picture of me like recording my very first song like I ever wrote. And I was in like an iron-on Trivium tee that I like ironed myself, and I like cut into the shape myself. So it's just been bands that I've followed for so long, like, you know, and I was surprised by how many of them were actually up for doing something. I guess it was during the pandemic, so everyone was kind of looking for something to do, which was convenient for me.
As far as having the vision for the album, when did you start to want to do this? Like, when did this begin? You know, where was the motivation, and how did this begin, this creative process?
It began around the beginning of the pandemic, I'd say, because, you know, we were sort of, I was just about to start kind of doing some live shows with my shred versions and stuff. I did one live show and then everything shut down. So I was like, oh, what am I going to do now? Cause I was kind of in this place where I wanted to overcome my performance anxiety and my imposter syndrome, because, you know, having had a relatively unconventional start to the music industry, I started online. So I'd always been kind of behind a screen where, you know, you can film something five times before you put it up online. You know, you have that little bit of control over what you're posting. So I kind of felt like in my mind, I'd set this kind of unobtainable bar that people would expect from me live, if you know what I mean, that I couldn't meet, because you can't record something five times when you're playing it live. It's just what comes out. So, and that sort of sparked, I guess, a lot of anxiety and kind of fear in me. So I was sort of on my journey to start to try to overcome that. And that's why I had my first live show and stuff. So I was getting ready, and then everything closed down, and I was like, oh, damn it. What am I meant to do now? So that's when we decided to, instead start writing this album that kind of told my story. And it was really healing for me because I got to chat to all of these people that had been, you know, heroes for me growing up, and all of them had like a really similar story of things that they went through. So I think that was, yeah, it was just really beneficial. And it's funny because it started, I knew I had the name of the album, Imposter Syndrome, before I even started writing it. I knew that's what I wanted it to be about. And it's funny because I started the album at that point where I was so nervous to play live. I didn't know if I could. And then when we released it was when, you know, I was out playing stadiums and I was on, you know, world tours and stuff. So it really does kind of follow that path.
As far as, you know, the starting out, you said online, you know, it's on social media. Mm-hmm. I had a very interesting conversation with Grace Bowers, who, mm-hmm. Who's 17 years old. She's in Nashville, and she started out very, you know, similar, playing songs online on Instagram and other things. And she always knew that she wanted to get on stage at some point, you know, and yeah. She plays in Nashville, like I think every night she's out playing on stage somewhere, cool. Which is great. When you were doing this, was that originally the end goal, was to get on a stage, or that just came by accident?
I think it was kind of by accident because like where I grew up, it was a very small town where there really wasn't a music scene at all. Like I was the only person who really like even knew what rock music was. Like I wore a studded bracelet to school once and I got suspended because, you know, it was like that kind of thing where it just wasn't really a thing. So I didn't really have the opportunity to go to like a jam night or anything like that. So my only kind of way I could meet other musicians and stuff was online, which was why I set everything up. And, you know, as getting older, I moved to London and stuff. And like, I think I always wanted to be on stage in a rock band, but it kind of always just seems like this unobtainable dream because no one I knew was a musician. You know, it just felt like a whole other world that I didn't know was possible for me, I guess, from this little town. So when I started to, you know, meet people who actually did that and stuff as I started to get older, that's when it did start to be like, oh, like that is something I would love to do. That looks so cool. But, you know, I always wanted to be, I'm a perfectionist, so I would always want to go up there and perform my best. So I guess that's where the anxieties came in from there. But yeah, that's sort of always what I wanted to do. And I'm so grateful now that it is what I get to do. But I also love the online stuff as well. You know, I love all of it.
You mentioned your dad being a rock and roll fan, your mom's favorite singer, Lizzie Hale. How important was having parents that love the genre of music that you're in? I mean, obviously that may have been like why you are where you're at is because mm-hmm. of your parents and their love of music. But how important, you know, having parents that love the genre, that support you in playing in this genre, how important is that to you?
I honestly think it's been one of my biggest drivers, actually. Like I'm so lucky to have parents that support me so much, like with doing what I want to do. And so like my first album, well, my first like EP, I guess, Delusions, which was like this kind of instrumental 5-song EP that was originally written. It wasn't even written to go out to the world, but it was originally written as a Christmas present for my parents that I wanted to record these songs. And then, you know, on Christmas, I would give them the CD and have this little like homemade t-shirt and stuff, you know, just so they could have something to listen to that was me. But then it kind of all just, one of the songs went quite big on YouTube. Like I just posted a little teaser, not to get views, but just sort of as a, you know, a little kind of like a journal entry almost, so I could like track my progress with the song and stuff. And then one just got really big and my parents were like, I know you're doing this like for us, but I think you should like actually do some music videos and you should actually kind of put it out there a little bit. So they really encouraged that. And that, you know, kind of led to my YouTube channel growing and my followers growing. And, you know, I was very lucky. They supported me going to music school over I got a scholarship to study criminal science in Sussex. And a week before I was like, Dad, I don't think I want to do science anymore. And luckily he supported me switching to music. So that was great. And, you know, it's been amazing. It's been really, really cool to have them just be. My mum recently got a tattoo of my logo on her back, her first ever tattoo at my album launch party. I had a tattoo artist there and she just got my logo tattooed on her back. And like, I think she likes it. I don't know.
Well, she's got it, whether she likes
exactly.
it or not.
At least it's on her back so she can't see it.
Right. That's always the best place to put a tattoo that you don't know if you're ready. Put it on your back so you never
exactly.
see it. Or the back of the neck. Like,
yeah, just hide it back there.
Grow your hair out long enough for other people won't be able to see it too. That's great. I think, you know, my son who's just turned 19, you know, he plays guitar. He's been playing since he was
awesome.
12. And we remember just having the bond, or I do have the bond, not remembering, with him with music and how we have always listened to music, taking him to his first concert and you know, putting him in lessons and having him learn to play and then upgrading, you know, to a better guitar and all that stuff. So, yeah, you know, I've always told him too, you know, I'm like, hey, because he's at college right now. I said, you know, get your degree and you can go do whatever you want. If you want to go pursue a dream after that, go do it. So
exactly. And then's the time to do it when, you know, they're younger as well. And it's just, yeah, it's amazing having that support there. Like, I remember my parents used to, whenever I had like a band practice or something, they'd come and sit outside for like 2 hours in some random parking lot doing a crossword in the car, you know. My mum, when I had guitar lessons, she'd just sit outside in the car. Like, it really does make a difference, I think, to someone having the confidence to like pursue that dream.
Yeah, and for a parent, you know, you've got your kid practicing his guitar for hours on end on Fridays and Saturday nights. I know where my son is, right? I know where he is. He's practicing his guitar. He's not out doing whatever.
How is it from like a parent's point of view? Is it like annoying when they're playing so much, trying to learn a song? You're like, oh my God, stop.
I remember him trying to learn the guitar solo for Shock Me by Kiss.
Oh, yeah.
It's an Ace Frehley solo and it's a long solo. And there's a part in the song where he keeps messing up and I hear him in his room swearing and getting frustrated with the playing it, but he finally got it. And it was great as a parent because, you know, we always worry about this generation. We always worry about, you know, the work ethic of the generation, you know, previous or after us rather, I should say. And I'm hearing him fail and do it again and fail and do it again. And I'm like, that kid's going to be all right. My son's going to be all right because he understands that, like, you just can't pick something up and just magically be able to play it. And him being able to put that time into it and know that if he keeps trying, he's going to get it. And for me listening, you would hear it. You'd hear the progression from one part and then he got that part and he screwed up the next part, but he kept and then slowly getting that part and getting that part. And it was like a week's process of him mastering
That's
it.
Really
it was great to see that and hear that.
Yeah, that you can like see that the whole progression in it. And it's a good like kind of life lesson, I guess, you know, you're learning to kind of fail and get back up.
Yeah. And it's failing in such quick moments. Like you practice and you fail. You got to do it again. Practice and you fail. And then you start to get, and then you think like you got it. Like I got it. And then you fail at the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a great thing to see as a parent. And we, you know, I'm not going to get on any soapbox or anything, but you know, when we're concerned about, you know, them being on their phones or being on social media or being on video games, the guitar is any instrument is a great distraction to that.
Definitely. Yeah. It's definitely, nice to know that they're doing something that's so like productive.
And also being creative. I think, you know, having that, those moments where you're being creative, where you're allowing yourself to have a vision is also very important. Instead of having the vision put there for you, you know, like whether it's on social media or video game, have your own vision, have your own imagination.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, sort of inspiring you to be creative in your own right and not just follow what's trending or what's, you know, cool, I guess, on social media. I'm sure probably the neighbors would disagree when you got like the window open. Like 11 p.m.
Usually, once it gets to like around 11:30 and he's still playing, it's kind of like, all right, okay, you've been playing since like 2 p.m. We have a break, you know?
Yeah, okay, I'm good for tonight.
When you think about where you've come from, you know, the university, learning guitar, having a social media presence to now touring arenas and playing live shows to releasing your album. Mm-hmm. What has been, obviously this whole thing is probably a big surprise in some way, right? I mean, the way it's all unfolded and developed, but what's been the biggest thing that you never expected from just sit playing, you know, to a audience on social media?
I think definitely one of the pinch me moments was when we played the Cleveland Brown Stadium, which was to like 60,000 people or something on like my very first tour. Was like such a incredible moment to like just see. I remember when we went into the stadium the day before, and pretty much all of the band just like burst out crying. Like it was such like an emotional moment just to look around and see kind of what everything has led to from all of our different paths. It's all like led us there. And it was just such an awesome moment because there was this one particular moment from that show where Kel's got a bunch of young kids on stage to like come and like dance and like just, you know, rock out on stage. And this one girl got on stage, and usually they're all kind of dancing, you know, around him. He's like the singer, he's the guy. But this one like girl got on stage and she just made a beeline to me. She ran right over to me, gave me her hat and was just like rocking out with me. And it was just such like this really, I don't know, this really kind of beautiful moment to me that like, I kind of, it's so cool to see your like kind of inspiring people, like young people like that. It's just, I don't know, it was just really, really full circle and nice because, you know, I was that kid as well. I was that kid that was so in love with bands and, you know, would draw them pictures to give to them, you know, would make little gifts, would make bracelets for them and stuff. And it's so amazing to like sort of be on the other side of that, I guess, because I relate to them so much. I was that kid, you know, at the barrier of every show screaming every word like that. It still is me, really. You know, so I think that's something that was really, really special that I'll always remember.
When you look out to a crowd like that, and you're playing in front of a huge audience, and got these screaming fans and these shouting fans and everything, and you think of your path, how, I mean, do you ever have a moment on stage where it like sets in, or is it just too enormous of a thing to even, a few years ago, to even possibly imagine that you still haven't grasped it yet?
I think I still haven't, I feel like it still hasn't quite sunk in that it's like kind of like a job, if you know what I mean, that's like what I get paid to do. I do have like this nice moment towards the end of the show where we play like a lot of a softer song and I don't play for the first, the first part of the song. So I'm just sort of, I'll usually go and sit up by the drummer. And everyone, it's like the part of the show where everyone puts like their phones in the sky or like their lighters. And I love that moment because I literally just get to sit there and watch the crowd, if you know what I mean, and see people having these, making these like core memories for themselves. And it's so beautiful, like seeing people hugging their friends, crying, or like, do you know what I mean? Like it's just, and that's when it really sinks in for me, like the kind of power that music has on everyone. It's just like, I don't know, it's such a beautiful moment, and I'm so grateful that I get to be a part of creating those moments for people. But I still don't think it's like then, but then I come home to my house in England, and you know, it's really not like, and I just in the bath with my two cats and I'm just chilling with my cats, you know. it's funny to have like both sides of the coin, I guess. But it's very special. I don't think it'll ever sink in really completely.
Well, how is your performance anxiety?
It's definitely so much better. Like, I think the process of, like I said, writing the album, just talking to, you know, some of my biggest inspirations and hearing that they feel the same things, and like, it's not just me, I'm not alone. And also just getting to kind of practice performing, you know, when I'm on tour and stuff, it's helped it so, so much. But now I'm kind of at the point where now I've released my own album and now it's time for me to go on tour with my own music, which it definitely, you know, I guess holds more kind of, it's my own thing, you know, it sort of, it holds more power, I guess, for me to be like the kind of actual front woman, you know, and I have to, you know, do the speaking to crowd and all of that stuff. And that's something that I'm definitely a little bit nervous about, but I've kind of managed to shift my mindset where I'm nervous, but I'm also really excited about making these stories. And if, you know, something goes wrong, it's not the end of the world. It's just like, that's what happens with live music. And that's the beauty of it. So I've definitely like just got into a lot better headspace about it all. So yeah, fingers crossed all goes well. And yeah, we're hoping to tour sort of the UK, at least like smaller UK shows around March or April time will be our first kind of live shows.
Now, March, April time, is there any plans for the rest of the year? Is there any plans to come to the US?
So we're doing US with MGK. We've got like a big, a bunch of dates around summer. I'm thinking probably for my own stuff, I reckon the US will probably be next year instead, because I think towards the end of this year, we'll probably do UK and Europe and stuff, because it's just difficult, like getting like visas for all of your band stuff. There's so much that goes into it. Like there isn't just the tour, like that you need to think about, especially when it's like a whole different country. So we'll probably do more UK, Europe this year, just to see what the live demand is for me as well, because I haven't really played live shows. I don't know whether the numbers on social media will transfer to live shows or not. So that's something that we kind of like, the last thing I'd want to do is like, you know, be playing like a 5,000 cap and like 10 people show up. So we've sort of got to test the waters to see what's actually a good number, a good venue size and stuff. And then once we have a really kind of firm idea of what we want the live show to be as well, because obviously I'm an instrumentalist. Do we get a vocalist in? Do we rely on more backing tracks? Do we have like a screen with the vocalist performing, you know, to a green screen or something that we play a pre-recorded video? Like we've got a lot of things that we want to try out first. And then once we know what we're doing, which hopefully we will by the end of the year, then we'll, you know, think about hitting the US next year for like a proper first headline tour or a support tour actually would be really cool with another band. I'd definitely be up for that if that came around.
You mentioned the singing in the vocalist, you know, earlier in, and how incredible was it for you? You mentioned you laid down the instrumental track for the singer. And then when the singer sent stuff back, like the song probably took on a life of its own more so than you could ever imagine. Was that, how was that in terms of the process, like being blown away by what people are sending to your music?
Yeah, it was really cool, especially when it was like a artist that I'd followed for so long as well, like hearing their particular voice, like on my songs, it felt so surreal. I was like, the first one I got back was Tyler Connolly, who's from a band called Theory and a Dead Man, Theory of a Dead Man. And I was just like, he has such a unique voice. So hearing his take on like, and what he did there was like, I could never have written like a melody or lyrics like that. Like it really just gave the song like a life of its own, gave it this new meaning. And it was cool because they took what I told them, like when I'd send the song over, I'd tell them a little bit about what the album was about, what I kind of wanted that song to be about. Like I give them a little description and they could use it or they don't have to. Like I kept it pretty free for them. And most of the time, like they did. And it was just really cool just seeing it like actually come to life. And suddenly it's this actual song. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. I mentioned the Nathan Lane song and I love the Lizzie Hale. I love the Blackstone Cherry song.
Thank you.
All that stuff is absolutely phenomenal. Everything is great on it. I mean, for those listening, it's a wonderful album. It's a wonderful artistic, creative journey for Sophie. And it's one of those albums that you get done listening to it and you got to listen to it again. So
thank you so much.
It's really, really good. Now that this has been out and you've been able to kind of like sit with it, I mean, maybe you've been sitting with it for a while, but now that it's out and now you're having your fans listen, how is that for you? How's that moment for you? Is that all this thing that you've been creating is out for people to listen? It's no longer just in your head.
Yeah, it's weird because we've had the album, like the album was done for like probably about a year or so before we actually released it. But then everything, you know, with MGK came up, a lot of stuff came up. And like you have to, when you're doing a collab with so many different people, so many different labels, you have to try and coordinate a release date with, like it becomes a bit of a nightmare. So just to have it out was like the album party, I think was one of like the best moments of my life. Like all the pictures, I look so deliriously happy. Like my smile is so ugly because I was just deliriously happy that it was out. And just to have people's like feedback on it, to hear like people's favorite songs, like to hear, you know, like if anyone's like singing it or something on their Instagram stories, people will like post a video. And it really does just kind of, I don't know, it's such an incredible feeling. But also there is kind of that feeling of like, okay, what's next? You know, like, I feel like I'm never 100% satisfied because I'm like, okay, it's out, but now I need to, you know, start doing something else. I need to have a new project. So it's lovely. And I made sure I had a couple weeks off to just like enjoy it and feel it. But now I'm like, right, on to the next thing. What are we going to do?
Are you all, I mean, I imagine every artist is always thinking like, what's next? Do you have ideas of what direction you want to go to for a next, another project?
Yeah. Like what I think I'd like to do is probably do more singles rather than albums, at least for the time being. And I'd like to work with vocalists or other musicians saying actually in the studio, because with this album, as I said, it was done during the pandemic. So it was all done like over Zoom or online, sending things back and forth. So I'd like to actually be in the studio with people working on things, and also working with people from different genres that you might not usually expect a kind of traditional rock guitarist to work with, like maybe like some rappers or like some gospel singers, I think would be really cool. And like creating, bringing like some genres together and seeing what happens. And maybe it sounds great, maybe it doesn't. But that's what I'd like to do, just get a little bit more experimental with some things and just have some fun thinking outside of the box.
Who's your dream to collaborate with?
Oh, that's a really good question. I'd say probably, I don't know, maybe Beyonce would be really cool. She's such a queen. So let's dream big and say, yeah, Queen Bee.
That's a great answer. Well, Sophie, I appreciate the time and I appreciate, you know, the conversation with you. It's been a great time having you for your first time on the Hook Rocks. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so much fun.
Absolutely. All of Sophie's information will be in the show notes. So once you listen, scroll down and you'll have the links to where you need to find all her social media and her website and where you can order the album. It's a fantastic album and I highly recommend it. Once again, I'm Jay Scott. This has been another episode of The Hook Rocks, the Ultimate Rock Music Podcast. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we will talk soon. Thank you.